Please be turning to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Let me confess, if you've looked at a term card and you've put any trust in it, that one of the things the bomb we've all discovered does is that it provides a wonderful excuse for not doing what you said you'd do. And I need to confess that I'm not going to begin the series on Exodus this week. I'm afraid I've not had time to work that up properly, and it seemed the wrong thing to start with a dud. But we will begin next week. And we're going to look at this book. It's a tremendous book that greatly influences the rest of the Bible. And the way we're going to tackle it this term is by looking at some of the New Testament passages that want to bring out its applications. So it'll be an immense help if you've read the right passages in the book of Exodus. And if you've read the first three chapters for next week, that'll give us a great start. But today I want to study some of the least Christian lines in the New Testament. They're written by the Apostle Paul, and you'll find them in this chapter. I think if you wanted to sum him up in this chapter, you'd have to say he is the reluctant bragger. The reluctant bragger. Imagine you were doing an interview with Paul. You wanted to put him on the spot for something. You obviously wouldn't send a junior along to interview him. You'd have to have someone on the par with the Brian Waldens, the Robin Days. You might bring Dick up to come and do it. He might be able to score a useful point or two. And there's the interview. You're glued to your set. Well, you're not really, because they're fairly predictable interviews most of the time, aren't they? And you're listening and you're nodding. And suddenly it begins to dawn on you, actually, the apostle is looking rather uncomfortable. Now you are really watching. And it wasn't just that your cocoa was leading you astray. No, he's squirming in his seat. You've reached 2 Corinthians chapter 11. That's how he seems to be as he writes this chapter. Look how he begins, I wish you bear with me in a little foolishness. Do bear with me. If you read through the chapter, you'll find this theme comes back again and again. He wants to be foolish. And yet he doesn't want to be foolish. Look at verse 17. What I'm saying, I say not with the Lord's authority, but as a fool in this boastful confidence. Since many boast of worldly things, I too will boast. This isn't really very Christian, what I'm about to say. I'm speaking just like a fool. Now, it's the second half of verse 21. Whatever anyone dares to boast of, I'm speaking as a fool. I also dare to boast of that. Verse 23, I'm talking like a madman. Imagine what a field day the press would have with lines like that on the headlines. Apostle confesses all, he is a fool. Madman, admits Paul. Now, what's going on? Well, he's writing to the church he founded. Paul planted the gospel in Corinth, and now other teachers have come along, and there's nothing wrong in that, but these particular teachers are leading the Corinthian Christians astray. He's afraid, according to verse 3, that their thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes and preaches another Jesus than the one we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or if you accept a different gospel from the one you accepted, you submit to it readily enough. It seems clear that it's a different Jesus, a different spirit, a different gospel that's being taught. They're high-profile teachers. They're referred to as the superlative apostles. Paul speaks of their boasted mission. And one of the ways in which they've managed to get the Corinthians to follow them is by running down Paul. So they speak of him as if he's unskilled in speaking. It's a bit of a drawback, you see, in an apostle, isn't it? If the next group of teachers come along and really Paul isn't in the same league as a speaker. And they say, according to verse 10 of chapter 10, that Paul's letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech of no account. He huffs and puffs when he's a long way from you, but When you get face to face with him, well, he's really a nobody. Very strange, isn't it, when people have their little caricature view of Paul as the great ogre? The enemies of his day thought of him as really rather weak. And the apostle fears that his verdict on these new teachers, the verdict he describes as Lynn read for us in verse 13, false apostles, deceitful workmen, now, that won't be enough to convince the Corinthians. So the question he faces is this: how to persuade these Christians that they're following the wrong apostles? That's not that strange a question, is it? I mean, I imagine we can't have knocked around the Christian scene very long without finding ourselves in something of this situation. We have Christian friends who seem to be involved in some teaching that, as far as we can understand, is leading them astray from what the Bible teaches us of God and Christ. And yet they're devoted to their teachers. How do you convince them they're on the wrong tack? Well, Paul writes this chapter as if he's driven to boast of his credentials. I think we ought to look closely and pay close attention to how reluctant he is to boast. Would that we were as reluctant. Take up the Christian press and look at some of the adverts for Christian organizations. Try not to read some prayer letters. No, most importantly of all, listen to some of the conversations that go on. Too often we're swapping boasts about rival Christian leaders and organizations and churches. I suspect we should be ashamed of boasting so freely about our strength, our skills, our training, our size. So easy, isn't it, to talk of how many people come to St. Helens. Aren't those things God-given? Isn't that what we want to say in our better moments? Well, there's nothing to boast about then. And surely the bomb reminds us we're not quite as strong and secure as our boasts might suggest. Now, do look what it took to get Paul to boast. It was the sight of his friends being abused and taken advantage of. Look at verse 19 and 20, will you? Says, listen, I'm going to speak like a fool, but then you gladly bear with fools, being wise yourselves. There is heavy irony there. Because look what you're putting up with the fools around you. You bear it if a man makes slaves of you, or preys upon you, or takes advantage of you, or puts on airs, or strikes you in the face. If these new teachers have come in and they've been of great influence in the Christian community at Corinth, they've taken it over. And look at the way they're lording it over that congregation. Oh, I dare say the striking in the face is metaphorical. It's quite clear what picture he's describing. To my shame, I must say, says the apostle, we were too weak for that. Now, there's heavy irony there as well. Of course he was too weak for that. That's not Christian freedom that's been described there. That's not the pictures of those who are following the Jesus that Paul has described. The Jesus who says, come to me all who labor and are heavy laden and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, learn from me, for I'm gentle and lowly in heart and you'll find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. You bear it if a man makes slaves of you. Praised upon you, takes advantage of you, puts on airs, strikes you in the face. The Corinthians, one commentator wrote, were not the last Christians to find ecclesiastical pomp and circumstance impressive. Groveling submission to it is hardly less evil than the original arrogance. Of course, you'll find it today. I still find myself shocked. I shouldn't have been, but when I remember back to a particular ordination service in a big cathedral, and as the procession came down the center aisle at the end, I was about 20 seats from the central aisle, and I suddenly found myself, as we'd all stood up, I was eyeball to eyeball with the bishop. Everyone between me and the bishop were on their knees in front of him as he walked out. Now, I think over-respect to bishops is not quite the biggest danger, perhaps, at St. Helens. It's more likely anarchic disrespect. We've got to find a less dangerous way of showing respect than that, haven't we? What kind of man of God are we expecting who can put up with that week after week and stay humble and not put on airs? We're not doing the bishops any favour. And of course, you don't have to be in the Church of England. You know, the same thing just crops up in different guises, in different settings, doesn't it? I was told firsthand from someone who lives in the area, only the other month, of a group of churches that I could easily belong to. And he said, Hugh, if you belong to that church, if you were single and wanted to get married, if you were married and wanted to have another child, if you wanted to move house or move job, you would have to ask the permission of the pastors before you did any of those things. You see, verse 20 is not something that's to be consigned to the first century in some extraordinary, weird little grouping. It's happening. And as Paul sees what these Christians of his have been reduced to, he'll do anything to show them what's going on. But what drove Paul to brag, you'll see from verse 2, is what he describes as a divine jealousy. Now, jealousy is one of those words that has only negative vibes for us, but that's not strictly accurate. Paul can speak of it as a divine quality. There is a wholesome jealousy. He says, I feel a divine jealousy for you, for I betrothed you to Christ to present you as a pure bride to her one husband. Now, the pastor who is not jealous that those he's been entrusted with stay true to Christ isn't a true servant of Christ. The pastor who isn't immediately going to be roused to action when someone's going to lead them away isn't a true pastor. There's a proper jealousy. And why I ought to be jealous if someone wants to take Claire away from me. She's my wife. She ought to be jealous if someone wants to get me away from her. Our problem is that we start boasting in the face of human jealousy. You've only got to tell me that someone else is better than me and I'll start wheeling out my credentials. Paul isn't doing it because of that. He's doing it because people are being led astray from Christ. It's only then, through gritted teeth, that he starts his bragging. The reluctant bragger. Now notice, will you please, as we come to look in more detail at the end of this chapter. Notice not just the reluctant bragger, but notice what it is that he's bragging about, what I've called the best of boasting. I don't mean one of those bedside book compilations of all the best boasts from the last X years. No, this is boasting as you've never heard it before. When he actually gets down to it, and it takes him about 21 verses to work himself up to it, he starts off in verse 22. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So am I. I've got the breeding and the background just as they have. I might be Paul of Tarsus, some little colonial city, but as a matter of fact, I'm a full-blooded Jew. So don't let them pull a fast one on you on that score. And then he comes to his real boast. Are they servants of Christ? Well, I'm a better one, he says. Now, how do you think he's going to go on? Well, stupid question, because you know it. It's been read to you. And imagine how you and I might have gone on if we'd been in his shoes. See, we might imagine Paul saying something like this, I've established more churches, I've preached the gospel in more lands and to more ethnic groups, I've travelled more miles, I've won more converts, I've written more books, I've raised more money, I've dominated more councils, I've walked with God more fervently and seen more visions. I've commanded the greatest crowds and performed the most spectacular miracles. And he could have said all of that with honesty. And that, as a matter of fact, was the kind of list that the pagan writers of the day did produce. It was the way you did your brag sheet. A self-eulogy. Now, Paul's brag sheet is a marvellous copy of one of those self-eulogies, right down to including numbers. When Augustus Caesar wrote out his little eulogy, he made sure he left nothing out, and he just included the numbers. 5 times I did this, 3 times I did that, a few more times I did the other. You know, it's like they say, isn't it, to the great football clubs. You have this sort of roll call of what they've done. You know, European Cup winners X times, Division 1 winners so many more times, Cup winners a number of times, Zenith Data Systems Cup winners. You know they're desperate when they've got to include that, and so it goes on. And you see, when you look at it, Paul's list is a complete send-up. Oh, yes, self-eulogy. Well, here we go. I won't leave out the numbers. 5 times, flogged. 3 times, shipwrecked. He boasts about what no naturally boastful person would even mention. If I must boast, verse 30, I'll boast of the things that show my weakness. See, he even ends it with a little cameo. Apparently that's what you did at the end. You put in a little illustration. Once you've done all the sort of factual bits and you recorded all the victories, you put in, look, this is an example of what I was like. It's like Jimmy Hill at the end of the match, isn't it? You know, you have that 15-second snippet of the action replay, which captures the essence of someone's game, the magnificent control and 40-yard pass or whatever it may be. Well, they would do it with some mighty military heroics. Only Paul didn't do any of that. He just described a humiliating escape in a fish basket. No doubt complete with the leftover smells. At Damascus, the governor guarded the city of Damascus in order to seize me, but I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped his hands. Oh yes, any pride I had vanished on that day. Yes, I was the one who came there to hunt out the Christians, and I left hunted myself. One commentator said, it's a definite part of his send-up. See, the finest military award you could get in those days, their equivalent of the VC, was given to the person who was first up the wall, first over the wall of the enemy town in face of enemy fire. You probably got it posthumously most of the time, but that's how you got it. Actually, Paul's point is very obvious. Oh, here's a cameo of what I was like, not first up the wall, but first down the wall. If I must boast, I'll boast of the things that show my weakness. The best of boasting. I've heard people say before now that the problem they find being part of the family here is that everyone at St. Helens is just too successful. So that's why they've left. You probably chuckle at the thought of it. You know yourself quite well. But of course it's the impression they've picked up. And even if we know it's not true of ourselves, it's the impression that very often we're immaculate at conveying. I wonder if one of the lessons from this is that we shouldn't be quicker to admit our weaknesses. Our pride runs very strongly in many of us. We've erected powerful barriers to any signs of weakness. It's not the mark that we're servants of Christ, that there's no weakness. To be cool, to be macho, is not any indication that we're a true servant of Christ. The way the world chooses to assess itself is not meant to be the model for how we're to assess ourselves. If we've got to boast, well, time to boast of things that show our weakness. The reluctant bragger. But the best of boasting, for he talks of what reveals his weakness. And lastly, notice this. You'll see it, I think it's brought out crystal clearly in verses 28 and 29. It's what I call the heart of the swank. at the heart of this swank, the apostle. For you see, when he speaks of weakness, he is not meaning wimpishness. There's no great Christian merit in proving that I'm a complete wimp. It may be true, but it has nothing to do with whether I'm a servant of Christ or not. The whole list of things, of his weaknesses, all stem from this question in verse 23. Are they servants of Christ? I'm a better one. It's all about being a servant of Christ. And you see, the mark of the true servant of Christ is not necessarily what I've done for him, what I've achieved. Much more accurate if I know what I've gone through for him. What I'll suffer is an indication of how I care. Because you see, love will involve weakness. Loving someone makes you vulnerable. If we'd gone through what Paul had gone through for a cause, it would be obvious we were committed to it, wouldn't it? And we'd have proved it far more effectively than to have led any number of great crusades or to have joined any number of strong churches. Now, the details of this list, of course, are peculiar to the apostle. But the principle applies across the board. And by the time we reach verse 28, I think it's where those two, the details and the principle, are coming closest together. Prison, flogging, shipwreck. Now, they're probably a fair way off for most of us. But the pressure of care for all the churches, care for Christ's people, why, there's a measure in which that can be ours. There's a sense in which, to some measure, all of us must and ought to face this pressure if we're servants of Christ. Apart from other things, he writes, there is the daily pressure upon me of my anxiety for all the churches. Are those he founded? Well, you'd expect that. But others as well. Now, there's evidence of it just in this Bible. He writes to the church at Rome. He writes to the church at Colossae. He wasn't responsible for either of those coming about. He's concerned for the whole people of God. If I'm a Christian, something of that concern comes on me. I can't divorce myself from the Christian family. It's why I need to maintain my concern for our missionaries. It's why I need to show concern when Christians from other lands come and join us. It's why praying for other parts of the world, even those with which we've got little or no contact ourselves, is all part of Christian service. For it does matter what's happening in America in the Christian scene. We can't just wash our hands of it and just blame the Yanks and be grateful for water between us. And apart from other things, there is this daily pressure, he writes. It's as if it's the climax of his trials, because it is the supreme mark of his care. Look, keep a finger in 2 Corinthians 11, and if you want a journey, come with me to page 191 for a moment, will you? I've shown these verses to some of you before, but they've made a great impression on me because they show very strikingly, I believe, how Paul related to his Christian friends. Here's Paul writing to the Thessalonian Christians. It's at the end of 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Christians he'd seen for only a few weeks, at best a few months. Look at verse 19. What is our hope or joy or crown of boasting before our Lord Jesus at his coming? Is it not you? You are our glory and our joy. Now, do you think that of any other Christians? Is that how you relate to your brother and sister Christians? Or look at verse 8 of chapter 3. He's sent to find out how they're getting on, and he's got the news back. And look how he writes, verse 8 of chapter 3, for now we live if you stand fast in the Lord. Ever felt that way about any other Christian? Whew, it's worth carrying on with the Christian life now. I can really live it because I know they're going on. Well, the Thessalonians were a fine, growing, loyal, supportive church. You come back to 2 Corinthians, just think, it doesn't need too many more like the Corinthians or the Galatians, and imagine the spiritual and emotional energy that the apostle would have poured out on them. The problem churches is, apart from other things, and what other things they are, there is the daily pressure. Don Carson in his commentary writes this: if Paul faces such pressure daily, it's not because a bad situation never improves, but because there's always a new one about to break. Nor is Paul's concern limited to churches that are in danger of apostatizing. He cares with equal intensity for fledgling congregations he's not in a position to help directly, but the newness of whose faith prompts the apostle to vigilant prayer and whatever is the spiritual equivalent of gnawed fingernails. Now there's the heart of this swank. See, these aren't words, are they, of a mere professional running some superb organization from the comfort of new offices in Plantation House. It's not as if he's able to say, well, the photocopier's repaired, the fax machine's installed, the phone lines are working now, we'll just press the buttons, we've got the machinery, and the whole show's on the road. Now, you read the New Testament, and Paul is a very organized man, by the way. That's impossible to miss that. He's sending out his delegates here, there, and everywhere else, getting the news in, organizing the collections. He's a very organized man. I sincerely hope St. Helens is a very organized church. Large institutions that aren't organized will almost certainly become careless. But you can't say he's a mere professional. You can't say he's just highly organized. These are the words of someone who cares. All Christians, even the most troublesome, are Paul's brothers. And the pressure they put on him is the pressure of love. If you're going to love troublesome people, troublesome Christians, well, you'll find the pressures he's talking about. He spells it out in verse 29. Here's just a couple of instances. Who's weak, he says, and I'm not weak. Isn't that the pastor's heart? For some reason, people are brought to a spiritual low. They're wearied. They're worn out. They're driven down. It may be physical. Paul knew about that. There's some debilitating illness. I imagine we all know people who've had them. Got them. Maybe it's a discouragement. A lonely Christian. Just hearing at lunchtime today about an old member of the family here. He's in a lonely place, village up north. A vicar who, for some unknown reason, is just awkward and obstinate and unhelpful. He's got two kids. They're just in their early teens. The youngest is my godson. Claire's mother's just spent a weekend with them. Her comment, which I'm sure is accurate from what I know of the situation, is this: they're very fortunate those children are still going to church. Yes, they'll feel themselves very weak in that situation. Oh, maybe it's just circumstances of life at the moment, a redundancy, a situation you can't escape at work, in your flat, in a marriage. Who's weak? And I'm not weak, says the apostle. Think I just shrug that off and say, well, what does it matter? There are plenty of strong ones around. How can triumphalists, one writer wrote, who boast only of strength and who despise all signs of weakness, ever provide any empathetic help to the fellow believer who's weak? Now, we must make our theology fit that kind of practice. There's an advert going around at the moment for a great mission to London, and the picture it shows, it talks about miracles, and it shows a picture of a blind person's discarded white stick and dark glasses. I mean, where is that going to leave people? Where does that sort of image leave a Jim Shedden? Very weak for all the last years of his life. And the friend who rang me to tell me of his death this afternoon, her immediate comment is, the one good thing is he's in heaven. What servant of Christ can't empathize with the weak? Well, if you're going to do that, you'll have to face the pressure that comes with it. Who's weak and I'm not weak? Who is made to fall? That is to say, who is led astray from following Christ? Who's made to stumble in their discipleship? And I am not indignant. Well, of course, it's just what's happening in Corinth, and Paul is very indignant. That's why he's writing the way he is. For he's making the point that sympathy alone is not the mark of the true servant of Christ. It's not enough just to be sympathetic. No, it's only when you ally indignation to sympathy, this kind of indignation, that you show the genuine care of the servant of Christ. And this is the indignation that Jesus showed. Well, yes, a little time for a last trip. Back to page 18 of the New Testament. For those who always want to blame Paul for the hard words, let's look and see them just as hard, just as indignant from Jesus himself, from the model of love, from the one no one would accuse of not sympathizing with the weak. Matthew 18, verse 6. I will start at verse 5. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, but whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone fastened round his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. It is a terrible thing to lead people away from Christ and the true and living God. Turn on a few pages to Matthew 23, page 24. Hear Jesus again. 23 verse 13. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut the kingdom of heaven against men. For you neither enter yourselves nor allow those who would enter to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you traverse sea and land to make a single proselyte, and when he becomes a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourselves. Woe to you, woe to you, woe to you, woe to you. The chapter's full of it. You're like whitewashed tombs, he says. And yes, there's an indignation that is a proper, Christ-like indignation. And it comes when someone is made to fall. Here is Carson again. How different are many of our reactions to the same phenomena today. It is regrettably easy to philosophize when such sin occurs, comment on the evil times in which we live, reflect that the brother or sister who fell into sin or heresy was never very strong or discerning anyway, and never to agonize in prayer for our fellow believer, or inwardly burn because of their weakness and shame. The really consistent triumphalist may actually entertain feelings of superiority in that situation and rejoice that he is not as other men are. That is horribly close to the bone, isn't it? Our indifference links us with the priest and Levite in the parable of the Good Samaritan. Now you see, here is the true heart of, if it's possible to be one, the Christian swank. Apart from other things, there is the daily pressure upon me of my anxiety for all the churches. Who is weak and I am not weak? Who is made to fall and I am not indignant? If I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. Well, if the bomb drives us to learn this, it will have taught us something invaluable. We're going to be far more scattered and far more disparate for the next 12 months, and we'll need in a year's time to be able to say this of ourselves and our experience far more urgently than we have before today. So let's pray God that He gives us the grace to do so. If I must boast, I'll boast of the things that show my weakness. Our gracious God, forgive us when we assess ourselves by all the wrong criteria. Our gracious God, give us a love for one another that means something of this care and burden, of this daily pressure that the apostle knew, is known in our lives as we're weak with those who weak, and indignant when people are made to fall. Help us in these coming months to be more truly servants of Christ for His name's sake. Amen.